Here we are in sunny Dania Beach today, and it really is sunny. It's so sunny that my feet are a little bit hot with this sand, so I'm going to put my sandals on, and I'm going to just sit back and talk to you about the cell structure and the function of the basic unit of life is going to be the cell. We already talked about the fact that we have the basic components, the elements. These elements are going to be combined and be organized into cells that are really going to be the start of what we're going to be considered life. And that brings us to the concept of the cell theory. The cell theory is that all life is based on the individual cell. And that's our cell theory. And really it was really over a period of time really came to this. Hooke in 1663 observed cork. So Hooke observed cork. And what he saw was is that there were little rooms inside of cork. What he did was he took probably a wine bottle, right, and a cork from a wine bottle, and he made a nice thin slice. And he looked at it underneath his primitive microscope and found that there were like different areas in it that looked like rooms. So he called them cells. In those days, rooms were called cells. Even today, in a monastery, if you go to a retreat, you'll get a room and they'll give you a cell. Or if you're unlucky enough to be a stay overnight in a facility that is trying to punish you, you would also get a cell in a prison as well. So cells are rooms, and if you think of cork, it's a dead plant. And plants, as you know, have a cell wall. So the cell wall makes these little, Hooke called little rooms. So these little rooms then were really his idea, calling themselves cells. And really when we look at the cork, it's really going to be representing a dead plant. So there's really no cell within it. All that's left is a remnant of that. And because there are these cells that are going to be containing air, that's why a cork floats, for instance. Now, there was a lot of controversy about the cell theory, it being the fact that cells are going to be the fundamental, basic aspect of life. And Pasteur did some work with bacteria, and he wanted to disprove an idea of the time in the 1800s. The cell theory was sort of coming into vogue, but there were still some dissenters. Some people thought that maybe life could arise from non-living things. So the cell theory would not really be holding true in this case. And they had some examples in their lives where they thought that, well, maybe this was true. Like, for instance, if they took meat and they put it out into the hot sun, eventually what would happen is that there would be maggots that would be growing from that dead tissue, that dead meat. So they'd see maggots growing and they'd say, hey, this is spontaneous generation. Life is spontaneously generated. There's no real rhyme or reason for it. It basically is going to be in the ether. So they said that the ether, or our air, is going to be where life could possibly come from. So all you have to do is just expose something to the ether, and then you're going to be getting life. So Pasteur said, well, this is bogus, that life comes from life. It's not like Frankenstein, where you can put a bunch of body parts together and make a new creation, no matter how much you put electricity through it. So he said, well, let me disprove this. So he came up with the famous Pasteur's flask. And Pasteur's flask is going to be shaped just like a regular globe. So you have like a globe. And then you'd have like a gooseneck on the top of the globe. So the gooseneck would be exposed to the ether. And then what he did was he filled this gooseneck with a medium that could grow bacteria, such as a soup. He made like a beef stew or a beef soup and put it in there, expecting that because this soup, which can generate stuff, is exposed to the ether, which would be in the gooseneck, then you would have the ability to have life being produced. But of course, about a week later, there's no life being produced. So some naysayers said, well, that doesn't prove anything. It's possible that the beef soup would not be able to generate life anyways. So what Pasteur did then was break the gooseneck and expose the globe almost directly to the ether, And sure enough, in a day or so, we had maggots starting to grow in it. So the soup would be able to sustain life. So still, people really didn't believe in that cell theory at the time. But they started to realize that maybe the spontaneous generation theory was a little bogus. And Pasteur said, well, the reason that we don't have maggots when we have the gooseneck is because we have the absence of flies. Flies are going to fly into the soup when we break the gooseneck. That's why we have the maggots. It's not coming from the beef soup at all. It's coming from the flies laying their eggs. So they said, well, why would a gooseneck prevent the flies? Well, because the flies like to fly. They don't want to walk, and they would not be able to navigate a gooseneck. So they wouldn't be able to get into the beef soup. They would be banging against the walls as they're trying to fly. So because of that, then, Pasteur is well on the way to disproving that there is the spontaneous generation theory, and on the way to saying that cells are going to be the basis of life. Speaking of cells, we have to think of what their shapes are. Shapes are going to be relative to what the cell is going to be doing. Like, for instance, a squamous cell would be a good cell to have on your skin. Nice flat cells. Cuboidal cells would also be good for, like, filtration. Columnar cells would be good in areas that are going to be roughened up, like your intestine. So these cells are going to be either flat, cubed, or they're going to be long, like columns. Now, cells are going to have a specific anatomy. And the cell anatomy, in brief, is just going to be a bag. So we have a bag filled with stuff. And the bag is technically called the plasma membrane. And if you hear the airplanes over, they like to go over Dania, the beach, a lot, because we're not far from the airport. And we have the plasma membrane, which is going to be that envelope. And inside of the envelope, or inside the bag, is going to be water and also stuff, such as organelles. We call them organelles because they're small organs. They're small organs that are going to be functioning for the benefit of the cell. Now, this water is going to be called cytosol. And cytosol is going to be really the water that's going to be within this bag, this cell. But we don't really call it cytosol if it has organelles in it. So if you take cytosol, which is really the water of the cell, and mix it with organelles, now you have a different kind of watery substance that's now going to be called cytoplasm. So cytoplasm is going to be a combination of cytosol, or the cell water, with the inclusions, they call them, or with the organelles. So if you put the organelles and cytosol together, you get a cytoplasm, and that's really what the water the watery substance, or let's say solution, of the cytoplasm or of the cell is going to be. Now, when we look at organelles, or these small organs, there's a principal one, and that's going to be right in the middle of the cell, typically, and that's going to be called the nucleus. So this is going to be different than when we talked about the chemical nucleus. The chemical nucleus was the center of the atom, but this nucleus is going to be the center of the cell, which is a lot more complex than just a single element. So when we look at the cell size, we have to think of limitations, because the cells can't get too big. They have a finite shape, not a finite shape, but a finite size. So we like to think that an elephant cell is going to be the same size as a mouse cell. The only difference is that the elephant, of course, is bigger, so he has more cells than the mouse does, but they're going to be equal as far as their cell size is concerned. And why is that? Well, if you think of a plasma membrane, or that outside covering, has to allow for food to get into the cell and for waste to get out of the cell. So we have to have a big enough plasma membrane to support the inside of the cell. Now, you can almost perceive that as you get a bigger inside, that's going to be a lot more stuff inside than there is plasma membrane to take care of the stuff inside. So as the the cell gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it's limited because it can't get rid of waste and can't get in enough food. So it's going to be limited by how big the plasma membrane can get. And if the inside of the cell becomes too large, the plasma membrane could rupture. That'd be the end of the cell. So it's a finite thing. You can't get too big because the plasma membrane will not be able to support the functions of the cell. Now, speaking of the plasma membrane, we call it a fluid mosaic because it looks sort of like, if you've ever seen a mosaic, which is like a picture that has little pieces of, you know, that could be pottery, that could be little pieces of just paint, could be little pieces of faces, you know. This is a mosaic that's really, if you get very, very close, you see that it's contained with all these little different pieces. But as you get away from it, you'll see that it makes a picture. And that's exactly what the plasma membrane is. It has a lot of different components in it. And if you stand away from it, you see it indeed looks like a mosaic. Because we have protein here. We have cholesterol in our plasma membranes. We also have a lot of fat in our plasma membranes. So really, we see iceberg proteins in a sea of fat. So it's like a sea of fat with these protein little buoys in it. The motion of these molecules creates the benefit of self-repair. We can't think of the plasma membrane as being very static. It's very dynamic. It keeps changing constantly. Because of this, it's able to repair itself readily. And it's very, very dynamic. When we think of the plasma membrane, though, we have to think of things going in and out of it. There are some things that are going to be allowed in with no problem. Other things are going to have to, you know, have a different kind of way of getting in. So, for instance, if it's lipid-soluble, remember, the plasma membrane is mostly fat, which is lipid. So if it's lipid-soluble, then it's going to get in. If it doesn't have a charge, in other words, if it's nonpolar, right, and also if it has a small size, it's going to get through the plasma membrane pretty readily. What things are not going to be getting in there are going to be things that have a charge. If you have a charge, then you're going to be either positive or negative. You're going to be attracting other things, so you tend to be bigger. Therefore, large things are not going to be able to come through as readily. We call this quality of the plasma membrane being able to let some things in and not let other things in as selectively permeable. Permeability would be the ability for something to go through something else. So if you can go through the plasma membrane, you're going to be permeable, or it's going to be permeable to that substance. But if you can't get in, then you're going to have a lack of permeability. So we call then the plasma membrane to be selectively permeable. Also, when we look at fat, we know that there's going to be fat incorporated in the plasma membrane. And this fat is going to be layered. We have two layers, one layer on the outside, one layer on the inside. And these two layers are going to be a phospholipid bilayer. So bi for two layers, and phospholipid because we have a lipid attached to a phosphate. We also have cholesterol in here, as we said. And also we have a combination of both sugar and fat. Put those two guys together. Sounds yummy, doesn't it? Put those two guys together, and we're going to be getting a glycolipid. We'll talk more about that later. But they're basically going to be a collection inside of the plasma membrane. And we also have a hydrophilic head, which is going to be phosphate, on each side. These are going to be polar, and a hydrophobic tail in the center. These are going to be nonpolar. Now, we talked about hydrophilic and hydrophobic before, but just to review, remember hydro means water, phobic means fear, like arachnophobia. Also, hydrophilic is going to be wanting to love water. Remember, philic means to love, like Philadelphia is the city of brotherly love. So when we see this kind of situation, we know that if we have a hydrophilic, that's going to be polar, so it's going to be more water-soluble. Those are going to be the heads. Whereas the tails or the feet or the legs are going to be hydrophobic. They're going to be nonpolar, so they're going to be more oil, more fat substances. Now, the proteins that are embedded within the plasma membrane are going to be two types. We have the transmembrane protein. We also have a peripheral protein. If it's transmembrane, that means like it's going to be going from one side to the other. So we have the transport, if you will. It's going to be going from one end of the plasma membrane to the other. Whereas a peripheral protein will just be on the outside or inside. So it's going to be maybe in one of the layers rather than in both of the layers, like a transmembrane protein. And a glycoprotein is going to be glyco, meaning sugar, and protein, meaning, of course, protein. We're going to have a sugar protein, which is going to be a receptor. These receptors are going to be important for the cell's identification. Your body recognizes these as self or non-self. These glycoproteins allow the body to actually utilize this identity. Like, for instance, let's say you have a hormone. Let's say you have a thyroid hormone, and it's floating in your blood, and it doesn't necessarily stimulate your big toe, because that big toe doesn't have the receptors for the thyroid hormone. It will only stimulate the thyroid because it has the proper identification. It has the proper ID, so therefore the thyroid will be able to stimulate just those cells called the thyroid cells. So usually these guys are going to be transmembrane proteins. They're going to be going through both of the bilipid layers. Now, these transmembrane proteins can also create channels. As we said, the plasma membrane is selectively permeable. Some things are allowed through and some things are not. This can facilitate things to come through or not because they actually make channels. So you have a transmembrane protein going from one end of the plasma membrane to the other end, and it can open up a hole that can allow other things to pass through. So we call these protein channels, which just assist, once again, in the selectively permeable aspect of the plasma membrane. Now, a lot of what the cell will do is to specialize itself. And the reason that is so that it can do a certain job. Like, for instance, if you put microvilli on top of columnar cells, this is going to increase the plasma membrane surface area. So you have not only an infolding of the actual columnar cells, but you also have an infolding of the villi, which are going to be on top of the columnar cells. And then you have added to that another infolding of the villi called microvilli. So what happens is that you've increased your surface area. It's sort of like having only, let's say, 1 mile square, and it's in a big city. How can you make the most money out of that 1 mile square? Well, you could build a house, or two maybe, or three or four, in that 1 mile area. Now you only sell four houses. But imagine now if you build a condominium. Now you have the ability to go up, so that 1 mile of land now is multiplied by how many stories you can build, 30, 40, 50 even. So now you've increased your surface area, if you will, or increased your income with just that 1 mile by building up. And that's sort of the way that the microvilli and the villi work. They increase the surface area, so therefore they cause more absorption. So we would see these like in the small intestine, for instance. Now we can also specialize the surface of columnar cells by putting hair-like structures on them. These are called cilia. Cilia will assist in transport. So if we have any kind of like mucus in our lungs, then these cilia will work sort of like whips. They like sort of push the mucus out of our lungs, and then we just cough it up. Another kind of cilia, but it's more specialized, it's going to be a flagellum. Flagellum is a long whip-like structure that is identical to that of cilium, but it's just one long tail-like structure. The only functional flagellum in the human is going to be the sperm cell. The sperm cell is going to have its head, which is going to be connected to its tail, and its tail is going to whip back and forth.